Welcome to the New Growth Podcast with Nikki Walton. Join her as she explores divine love as a key to spiritual growth, empowered service, and inner and outer success. If you'd like to support Nikki's podcast, please visit BeHereNowNetwork.com/Nikki.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of New Growth. I am your host, Nikki Walton, and today joining me, I have Humble, the poet, who is a best-selling author, a poet. You are a rapper, a YouTuber, spoken word artist. You do it all. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also, So quick story. I have lots of friends on IG and they always send me folks that I need to speak with. And you came through my, into my radar just last week from a friend. And he was like, you have to get him. You have to talk to him. And he actually sent along a couple of questions that he once answered. But I hadn't heard of you because I basically live under a rock. I think I've seen your name, you know, like from quotes on IG, but I had not done a deep dive. So I did the deep dive and I came across your music. And I came across a very appropriate song called Hair from, is it Righteous Ratchet, which is an amazing name. I love it. So I listened to the song and it was so dope that I went to find to see if it was a video for it. And I watched the video and y'all at home, please go watch the video for Hair on Righteous and Ratchet. If you haven't seen it, I mean, you probably have and I'm just super late, but I loved the way it was you rapping, but you had other people, you know, like it was your voice, but it was their faces. And one of my main spiritual practices is recognizing that every face is a face of God. So I thought, and I don't know if that was what your approach was, but that's how I took it. And it was really powerful. And the song is really dope. So thank you for that.
Oh, no problem. Thank you so much for checking it out. Yeah, it was the original concept was, you know, let's celebrate as much of different styles of hair as possible, but then realizing, you know, I'm from Toronto and I'm born and raised here, and this is one of the most diverse cities in the world. It's like, okay, let's celebrate real diversity, especially diversity around women. So the premise and the idea was to be the, you know, and my own battles with my own ego was like, okay, now you take a back seat,
right?
And let's have these extremely fly, unique, dope,
gorgeous,
represented. And then also, you know, all of them are from the city, with the exception of one who's from the Bay, but really showcase what diversity means. And I spent the last 5 years before the pandemic living in the States and really gaining an appreciation of Toronto, realizing that we're so much farther ahead in the world of diversity.
Like so much better.
And I mean, it's to the point where it's not just simply ethnic diversity, it's diversity of the archetype. So it was like, you know, when you watch this video for Hair, you're going to see not just only different women with different styles of hair, different colors of hair. You're going to see different body types. You're going to see different fashion styles. You're going to see different swags, different energies, different lifestyle choices, different abilities, everything. And it was just so awesome and dope to do it. And I mean, it's been 4 years, I think, since we shot the video, and just to see how many of them have gone on to really big things in their own. You know, some of them were dancers, some of them were entrepreneurs. You know, some of them were last minute choices, you know, because we couldn't find anybody else. And, you know, one of the girls was the actual producer of the video. And then when we couldn't find somebody to be in a certain scene, she's like, fuck it, I'll do it. And yeah,
I love it.
Yeah, one's a dentist now. And it's really, you know, one started a tea company. The female, she's in a wheelchair. She started her own tea company. And Oprah picked it up in Oprah magazine. So it was just like watching all these really cool things happen with them. But yeah, it was just this whole beautiful project and celebration of the city and diversity. And I'm so happy with the way it turned out. That was probably one of the first videos that I was able to completely not have to negotiate or compromise my vision in any way, shape, or form. And it turned out brilliantly and it was received brilliantly. And I'm super grateful for that.
Wow. Well, it's all new to me. And I could tell that it was way ahead of its time. So thank you. The diversity was amazing. Mm. The women were gorgeous and all the different hair textures, all the skin tones. It was right up my alley. So thank you. You said the word swag, and that was going to be one of my next questions, because I'm trying to figure out like your whole swaggy situation. Like, I talk to a lot of spiritual messengers, folks that they don't even consider themselves teachers, but they still have a certain way about them, you know, and you break all of those like stereotypes. You know, you got tattoos and you rap and, you know, you express yourself in a way that is representative of the culture and is leading the culture. So I want to know, like, who are you? Where did you come from?
I mean, as I said, I'm from Toronto. I'm from one of the most diverse places on the planet. I'm from, in many instances, I'm from the future. You know, I'm in a place where, you know, not only are we encouraged and uncomfortable to be how we came out the womb and the various cultures and heritages we have, but we're also encouraged to be who we're discovering we are. So, you know, I can, on a superficial level, say I'm a North Indian Punjabi boy, you know, whose parents came to Canada in the 70s and I was born here. But, you know, the truth is, as I uncovered myself, I'm an artist. I'm an artist first and foremost, beyond everything. And an artist's job is to add to the world, bring something new to the world. And hopefully that newness is beauty. And that requires, you know, having to counter the tribal mindset. You know, that requires us to live on the edge of culture. That requires us to have a critical lens for how we were raised and be like, okay, how much of what I was taught makes sense today? How much of that can I carry forward? And how much of that has to be left in the past? And how do I add on to that? You know, recognizing that culture and heritage isn't something static, and that the people 1,150 years ago didn't know more than we know now and didn't have all the answers, and things weren't better then. Things are better is tomorrow. And for things to be better tomorrow, we have to build more and, you know, not hold it against those of the past, you know, for passing down information that may or may not be relevant now. So for me, it's always been that. And I think, you know, my introduction into activism and understanding about a world beyond my little bubble was, you know, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Malcolm X, and really understanding that, you know, there's one thing to have a message. There's another thing to be the messenger. And, you know, realizing, you know, Malcolm X's impact, you know, didn't come simply from him preaching the right words. It was his Detroit Red Days. You know, him being a legitimate pimp, him, you know, having the ability to understand how to communicate and get an idea across way before he had a
authentically,
authentically, yeah, authentically, yeah. Way before he even had a good message to share.
Right.
And so I really, you know, I noticed that. And then also just paying attention to how I was influenced, like, you know, it was seeing Andre 3000 in a turban. Mm-hmm. You know, that made me feel cool. Yeah. And hearing his messaging and hearing his storytelling and being like, you know, there's a lot to be said about the applesauce that the pill is mixed inside. And my upbringing, where I'm from, you know, and then before even being an artist, I was working as an elementary school teacher. And again, the big idea there was, you know, to connect with your students. It's about how you deliver the ideas. Mm. It's not the idea, you know, it's not that a kid can't wrap their head around a concept. It's how we share that concept with them. Yeah. You know, whether we share it with our voice, whether we share it with visuals, whether we put them in a kinesthetic opportunity to try things out for themselves. So all of that has, you know, all those breadcrumbs were always in my life and leading me up to where I am today. While at the same time, you know, always recognizing, you know, as Dr. Seuss says, you know, why try to fit in when you were born to stand out? So, you know, the young insecure years of being a visible minority, you know, I had gone through those and as an adult realizing that, hey, you know, now's the opportunity. You know, you went through the tunnel, you went through the hardest parts of it, and you came out with a stronger sense of self, with an authentic confidence. And now is an opportunity to use that to add value to other people's lives and get other people to, you know, stand up a bit straighter and be more comfortable in their skin and to not only embrace the worlds they were raised in, but also to take a deeper dive into the world that they are, find out who's there and bring that out into the open, because none of us will truly feel connected if we don't have an opportunity to be our authentic self.
Right. Wow. That's powerful. You said a mouthful. I want to speak more to confidence and like that authentic confidence. How did you go from that awkward phase to stepping into yourself and to what we see now?
Well, first and foremost, confidence isn't an on and off thing. So it's not like you have confidence or you don't have confidence. So I still have plenty of moments where I wish I had more confidence. And to me, confidence is a foundation that we build. And
so
often
does confidence feel like to you? So in the moments where you don't have it, how does that feel? Like in the body or in the mind?
It feels like you don't have a foundation that you're standing upon. You know, if things feel shaky, if things feel uncertain, things feel unclear and foggy, you know, irrespective of what your brain's saying, your body is completely, you know, almost shutting down in different situations. So, you know, nerves, you know, sweats, heart racing, you know, a little bit of fear. But the interesting thing is it's feeling that and moving forward despite, which establishes the confidence, whether it's public speaking, whether it's walking up to a stranger, whether it's releasing a new project, whether it's, you know, telling the truth, anything that needs to happen that we're afraid of. And it comes with practice, you know, and we have to abandon this idea that there are confident people and not confident people. Somebody can be completely confident. You know, somebody can be completely confident standing in front of 10,000 people doing a speech, but they may not be a confident swimmer. Or they may not be confident dancing, or they may not be confident to say no to people. You know what I mean? Like there's different departments where we can have more confidence than others. And, you know, obviously in the things that I have inadvertently spent my 10,000 hours on, I'll have much more confidence. And in the things I'm brand new at, I won't. And I think it's really about finding those things that you're not confident at that align with your priorities and practicing them and being okay with that. So like, you know, this during the pandemic, I got into boxing, and the more I box, the more I realize I suck at boxing. But at the same time, I'm also finding the wonder of just having this sport deconstructed and revealed to me. So where before I just thought it was two guys punching each other in the face. Mm-hmm. Now I'm seeing the footwork, I'm seeing the timing, I'm seeing the rhythm. And this has allowed me to have a whole new appreciation for like Muhammad Ali, and I can go back and watch his fights from the 60s and the 70s and be like, wow, like look at his footwork, and you know, correlating that to mine and being like, okay, or watching even the UFC now, mixed martial arts, and seeing all the subtleties, because now that I have to do them, the movements, and realizing like you're not punching with your arm, you're punching with your body, you gotta pivot, you gotta turn, the pain that comes with that, you know,
right? I mean, not be afraid to get hit. I would be so scared the whole time, I'd be completely ineffective.
And that in itself is a whole thing where it's like, you know, I'm working with a trainer, I'm punching a bag or I'm punching pads. And then one moment he's like, okay, now you're going to block and I'm just going to come hit at you. And, you know, not even getting hit hard. And then just seeing how that impacts my thinking, be like, holy crap. Like, these guys are getting punched hard in the face. I just got tapped in the head and my vision is blurry. And seeing it as a very, you know, it can really, you know, it's a really great ego killer. Especially knowing that, you know, I'll never, you know, as a responsible adult, I'll never use this on the streets. And as somebody who's getting older, I'll never be a contender if I go into the ring with a bunch of, you know, 20-year-olds. You know, I'll just get my butt kicked. So I was just like, okay, what we're going to do is, you know, we're not going to wait. We're not going to practice this at the nightclub. We're going to practice this in the ring with a bunch of younger guys and get beat up. And let's just do that. So.
What got you interested?
Confidence. I think, you know, by default, it's already changed my ability to be around people, be in a situation to know I can keep other people safe. Also have a better relationship with my body, just to understand how it moves, to understand its limitations, to understand, you know, the importance of that. And I think also, you know, a whole new relationship with fear. As I said, like most of our fears are not generally related now to physical danger. Right. You know, they're related to humiliation, rejection, you know, neglect. And so just continually wanting to take a deeper dive with my relationship with fear, and then saying, okay, you know, not only am I boxing, I'm doing ice baths, I'm doing a whole bunch of other things. And it's like, okay, doing all these things that you're afraid of make writing that email a little bit easier, makes out there, makes asking for help a little bit easier. So it's really about, you know, doing these things to again, strengthen that foundation and be like, okay, you know, these are the things that we're capable of doing. So a lot of the day-to-day stuff that we experience in the first world that seems terrifying really isn't that terrifying anymore. And it's a strengthening, you know, having a better relationship with my fight or flight systems.
Beautiful. It sounds like your whole life is one big spiritual practice, like bringing awareness into everything. And
I really enjoy being a student. And I think, you know, for me, it's less about viewing myself as a teacher, and it's about being that student of life who likes sharing his notes. And knowing that when his notes are thorough, then that's also evidence that he's learning, you know, it's, you know, to better your own teachings. Right. It's you know, you have to share that with other people.
What's one of your favorite notes that you share?
I mean, a favorite note that I took recently in a conversation. I mean, I have sticky notes everywhere here. love in slow motion. You know, I think, you know, especially when it comes to romantic love, so many of us are outcome driven. We're not looking for the journey. We're looking for the partner. We're looking for the husband, the wife,
the end game,
the hashtag couples goals. But what we're not doing is we're not enjoying that journey. We're focused on the pot of gold and not the rainbow, realizing that the rainbow is what really is the reward.
Oh, speaking of which,
one second. My puppy is biting a wire. Sorry. Puppy, she's...
Oh, hello. So freaking cute. What's her name?
Boogie.
Oh, that's what I call my daughter. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and she came out dancing. So she's been Boogie ever since.
Oh, that's so wonderful. I'm sure your daughter isn't biting on wires like Boogie.
Hopefully not.
Boogie feels neglected right now, so she's taking it out
Boogie.
By
I'm
biting
sorry,
wires.
Boogie. I won't take too much longer.
It's all good. No, it's all good. This is part of the process. She is.
How old is she?
She's turning 3 months next week.
Oh my God. So you in it. My sister just got a puppy. It's been about 4 months now, and they haven't slept. It's like constant, you know, trying to keep pee and poop off the floor. They have a new house. It's like incessant. I'm like, girl, good.
It is definitely a practice of accountability and selflessness. And that was one of the motivations behind getting her was, you know, kind of undoing some of the ways I was raised. I was raised in a suck it up household, which I think many of us were.
Yeah, for sure.
And now I'm working with a very vulnerable creature who I can never say to it, suck it up.
Suck it up. Exactly.
I have to be empathetic. I have to hold space. I have to be nurturing. I have to be accommodating. Yep. I have to revisit and reconcile my relationship with idealism. So in the beginning, I'm like, she's going to be perfect. I'm going to teach her all these dope, amazing things. And then realize,
she's going to teach you patience.
She's teaching me patience, flexibility. Yeah. I have to remember and try to look at life through, you know, the eyes of a little walnut brain that she has.
Oh, yes.
I mean, again, she's easier than the average pup anyways, but it's just been such an interesting, dope journey. Oh, yeah.
What's your neck tattoo say?
I have both sides of my neck done. So
the one I saw was the other, but I want to hear about them all. Yeah, so that's what I saw.
Freedom is having nothing to lose.
True. That's very true. Because fear comes when you're holding on to stuff.
Yeah. And we're free the moment we decide we're free, not the moment that we achieve the freedom. Yeah. And I learned that from a Holocaust survivor that I met on a plane.
Wow.
And we just had this magical, brilliant conversation. And
that's the best, those plane conversations. Those hours fly by, they go by.
And it was a long flight, and it was just a magical moment. And I'm so grateful that it happened. And I have that. And on the other side, I have Punjab. So Punjab is the area in South Asia where I'm from. Punj means five, Ab means river. So to be Punjabi is to be from the five rivers. And
that's beautiful.
Politically, half of Punjab's in Pakistan, half of Punjab's in India.
So, interesting.
Yeah, my mom's from the India side.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I've only been to India once. I went to Mumbai in 2015 and I was heading back last year and then COVID happened and I'm hoping to go next year to Delhi area, everywhere around there.
Yeah, they're having a really tough time right now. So
I keep getting all the messages and they're saying it's like lack of oxygen and supplies and
Yeah, it's and it's also just unfortunately an extremely overtly apathetic government. You know, I feel like, you know, many of us have experienced, you know, lip service from governments. That's not even a government that does that.
Wow.
So when they're shown footage of people begging hospitals for another bed, they're just like, oh no, that's not everybody. That's just a rare moment. You know, they're not even saying, I feel sorry for that person and banning Twitter and banning Facebook from allowing any type of tweets and content that is critical of them. And threatening Twitter and Facebook employees with arrests if they don't comply. So this is a democracy.
Right. I was going to say, my friends are DMing me like it's a dictatorship over here.
Yeah. Even though it's supposed to be a democracy, it's the country is being exposed for what it really is. And I'm really hoping, despite how horrible it's getting and it's only getting worse, that some long-term sustainable positive change comes from this.
Yeah. Is there anything that we can do to help or to be allies here?
I think spreading the word. I think, you know, in general, anybody who's in a position of privilege, when they speak on behalf of those who don't have that privilege, the message is that much stronger. Many of us, especially in the first world, it's easy for us to focus on how we are part of the marginalized communities, but we're also part of privileged communities. We live in countries with running water, access to free, access to internet, access to medical care, and in other parts of the world and where the majority of people live, that's not the case. So when it comes to this, spreading the word, especially when citizens within the country can't, at the fear of getting arrested or any other punishment, letting the current administration in that country know that the rest of the world is watching, so holding them accountable, I think is the best thing. And I'd say donate to Amnesty International, but they've already been had their bank accounts frozen by the government and expelled. Yeah, so you know, organizations that have credibility in the space of helping those who need help are being shut down as well. It's getting really bad. Yeah, it's a we could go on for an hour about how bad it's really getting there and the nuances of racism. And the organizations that are in power there and how they relate back to, they go as far back as the Nazis. It gets really bad over there. Yeah. And the current head of the administration there, their current president, prime minister, before he was prime minister, he was banned from the United States for human rights violations.
Good.
So just to show you his resume, that was George Bush. George W. Bush had him banned from the United States because he was violating human rights. He incited riots in his home state in India. He's welcome with open arms because he's the prime minister. And, both Obama and Trump welcomed him with open arms. So, the game's rigged either way.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Wow.
And I think especially now, as philosophies and ideas and concepts that have their origins of that part of the world or have made their way over here, and everyone's eating turmeric and doing yoga and saying words like karma and meditating and creating a new world of spiritualization, the very least we can do is support the people where this came from. And not just take, let's contribute, and we can contribute with our voices and amplify what's happening and speak on behalf of those who can't speak for themselves right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I feel a responsibility to be able to use my platform in that way. Like when my friends were messaging about the farmers, I guess that was at its height you know, like within the last 6 months, at least for me, it came on my radar then. And to be able to use the platform to share and then to tell my audience like how they can help, how they can support. But it was interesting though, because no matter what you share, you're going to have people in the comment section like, well, you don't understand and you don't know. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, it always feels to me that if there's people fighting for something, I'm going to stand in love with them because they're upset for a reason. And it's, you know, folks are sending me this and it feels like it was more than what I was able to just read online. It was deeper than just what I was seeing.
And that's the thing. It's, shout outs to Rihanna for, you know,
absolutely
shining light on that as well. And as I said, like that got international attention because people mm-hmm. outside the country started speaking on behalf of them. And I come from a descendant of farmers and, the laws that they're protesting, you know, were passed very quickly and quietly during the pandemic. And any type of efforts to, you know, speak about these laws or whatever, were met with violence. And it really is about narrative building. You know, at this point, you know, it depends on who, you know, what side of the story.
Who's selling the story? Who has the platform?
Exactly.
To tell
who's
the story.
Selling the story? And, you know, unfortunately, that hasn't been resolved either. Yeah. And the challenge with all of this is, you know, one of the political ploys that, you know, the current administration did there was to, you know, I'm in Canada, so our prime minister, he made a comment of, we will always support people in any democracy to peacefully protest, mm. which India took as an insult. But to ensure that Canada didn't make any more comments like that, you know, India sent Canada vaccines because India has one of the bigger manufacturers of vaccines. And, you know, they did that at the cost of their own people. You know, you see the political plays that happened there. And I want people to understand that it's not, okay, my people are farmers. I care about this cause because they're my people. Because when you zoom out, it's the working class is fighting against governments who are selling their land, resources, and livelihoods to corporations. Mm. And that's happening everywhere. Yeah. You know, that's happening in Germany. That's happened in Central America. Unfortunately, when you go to the grocery store, whatever stickers on that banana that you're buying, you know, that company, they mm-hmm. have a track record of human rights violations. They have a track record of stealing land from independent farmers, turning people who own farmland into farm workers. You know, this is happening everywhere in the world. And just the current fight now is happening in India, a country where over half the entire working population works in agriculture. Yeah. And, you know, this is building momentum up where, you know, you have an individual in charge who, as I said, human rights violations to the T, but also, as I said, he was a mentor to Donald Trump. Donald Trump wished he had the power that this guy had. It was a significant hard thing. And, you know, this is something important I want to tell people, especially on their spiritual journeys. You know, who's selling the ideas is important, but mm-hmm. how spirituality is being sold to us is also important. And there's a lot of spiritual practices that are really well disguised and well, you know, as well meaning, but they're actually taking us further away of what
speak on it. Yes. And
again, you're allowed to have your own opinions, but my personal belief is especially if you believe in any type of Eastern philosophy, whether mm-hmm. that's Sikh philosophy, Buddhist philosophy, Hindu philosophy, whatever, the ego is the enemy. In so many ways, the ego is a barrier to so much peace. However, we're being sold spirituality by stroking our egos.
Exactly. It's taken us further into ego. Because now we're a practicer of spirituality.
Yeah.
That's my
talk about
ego.
what the universe is telling us. Yeah. You know, everything's conspiring for us. It's all about us. We look at our astrology. We look at all this. Yeah. What is important and what will actually make, you know, what the antidote to the pain the ego causes is love. And you know this because we all chase love. When you fall in love with somebody, you start to melt your ego. You don't see them, you don't see you see in us. You create a connectedness. You know, if you want more of that connectedness beyond just a romantic relationship, it's connectedness with everybody. And one of the biggest practices for that connectedness is service, servicing other people. And if your spiritual teachings don't include Deva. That, Deva, yeah. It's Siva. And if your spiritual teachings don't include that, if it's not mentioned, if it's not part of the practice, then realize that this has been packaged in a way to profit off of you.
Exactly.
It's great. You know, do your yoga, do your different types of meditations, take your ice baths, read your astrological signs,
charge your crystals, light your incense.
Do it all. But if there's no service involved, well, there is judgment.
I'm trying not to judge because, I mean, I too, you know, I don't do any of those things really. But yes, I know that everybody is in different places.
I'm saying do it all, but if there's no service, you're headed in the wrong direction. You know, it's like some people use artificial sweeteners instead of sugar because they think it's healthier. And
it's very frustrating.
it's the same idea. It's just... Yeah. If there's the easiest way, the two lessons I learned around spirituality were judge your spiritual teacher by how loud they laugh. Mm. And I think that's a brilliant one. As somebody who's been going to spiritual camps since he was 6-7 years old, judge them based on their laugh. The ones that take themselves too seriously, run the other way.
I love that.
Number two, service. If service isn't involved, there's no evolution involved in this. All that other stuff is cool and it's important, taking care of yourself, servicing yourself, all of that is great, but there has to be service to other people. And that service can be helping those less fortunate. That service can be helping family members. That service can be giving 10% of your income. I don't care what that is, but this idea of service, this idea of understanding that you are a part of something bigger than just yourself, that is extremely important. And so when we talk about what's happening in the world, those that control messaging really want to divide us, and that's how they conquer us. You know, whether they say Democrat, Republican, whether they say patriot or terrorist, whether they say black or white, all of these are designed to make people take teams and pick sides. Mm-hmm. And what's happening right now in India is not about Indians or Punjabi people or farmers. It's about working class people standing up for their right to make a living against governments who are selling their ability to make a living to corporations and corporatizing it, which we see happening all the time. But we don't see it happening this quick. Even Uber, for example, took out the taxi industry. It happened slowly over 6-7 years. It didn't happen in a summer. You know, that's what's happening here. This is happening very quickly, very violently. And it will continue to happen unless there are pages in history that show that the people won't put up with this shit.
Right.
And that's what's important. This is happening in Myanmar. This was happening in Hong Kong. This is happening in other parts of the world. It's the people versus the establishment. And it doesn't have to be a conspiracy. When there's profit to be made, this stuff is going to happen. You don't have to watch a lot of weird YouTube videos to find out what's going on. This is literally people doing this stuff for profit. And the simple fact is a human, you know, sitting on the 55th floor and he's a CEO of a big company, he's not evil. He's just so disconnected from what's happening to the average person that he doesn't feel it when he's hurting someone. Right. The same way the president of the United States can order an airstrike. And since he'll never have to see the bodies, he'll never feel it.
Exactly.
So, you know, this is not good versus evil. This is any human being would be capable of doing this stuff if they're disconnected from each other. And the solution here is connecting with each other. And connection, by definition, is not being near somebody. It's understanding somebody and caring. Somebody and feeling understood and feeling cared for. And that's why there's so many of us who have so many people in our lives that feel lonely, because we don't feel that connectedness. That connectedness comes from feeling understood and feeling cared for. And the best way to combat that loneliness is to first seek people to understand and seek people that you can care for. And again, I'm not telling you who to care for. I'm not telling you who to serve. Please include service into your diet and your spiritual. It is more important than all that other stuff combined.
I agree. I believe, you know, for me, I was doing some service always. You know, I get a lot of emails from people that are hurting, that are suffering, and I respond, you know, at length. I take phone calls for free. You know, if I can see that this is a person that is truly reaching out, and they're always like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you replied. But it feels like I don't have a choice. Like I couldn't just leave that, you know, in my box. But I reached out. One of my uncles is a pastor and he feeds people in a neighborhood in Pensacola, Florida every single Saturday. He goes and gets food from all over the city and brings it. It's like about 1,000 people that come out every weekend. And there's like, they have to have police there, you know, to like escort the crowd. And to be able to contribute in feeding people lately, that's really been speaking to me. And I don't know how to get started, but I don't know if you have anything to share about that.
Yeah, I have a friend who, you know, every Saturday he volunteers at a soup kitchen. And when he describes it, he doesn't describe it from a sign of virtue. He describes it from it, like the necessity of it is therapy for him to, you know, to gain perspective and connecting with other people, to be in service, to move, to connect with other people, to hear other people's stories, to practice the art of humanizing people. You know, it's very challenging to humanize people that we see through our screens. And again, you know, isolation is further fed in our social media culture, because everything is a metric. I post a picture, I count the likes. This is not me saying I'm going to be my authentic self and I am sharing this with people who I know understand and care for me. It's I'm going to let the people decide what they like. Do they like that picture of me in a bathing suit? Do they like that picture of me with my puppy? Do they like that picture of me with my family? Or do they like that picture of me when, you know, I haven't been taking care of myself or what have you? Mm-hmm. And it takes us the exact opposite way. We don't get to be our authentic selves. We're not encouraged to further discover our authentic selves because we're not in an environment where we feel safe to be ourselves, cared for, or even understood. Yeah. And when we go out and we service, and it can be anything. You know, I live down the street from a vegan burrito spot, and every Saturday they hand out burritos to those who need it, and they pretty much they didn't organize anything. There's a community grocery store two blocks away. It's a challenging neighborhood over there, and they just catch people who are standing in line there, and being like, "Hey, while you're standing in line, here's a burrito." You know, this will keep you full for half a day. Yep. And, you know, hand out the burritos. When we're done, we leave. Nothing needs to be said. No pictures need to be taken.
Exactly.
And all of that.
Exactly.
Because again, there's the idea of the ego, validating the ego, validating the self. Our ego is everything that we're not. And I understand it. It's the easiest way to sell something to somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you make it about them. When we can, but we feel the greatest when we melt our ego, you know, when you're holding your baby child or your niece or nephew, you know, and your ego melts and everything is about them and you will do everything and anything for them. Your own needs and concerns don't matter anymore. Or when you love somebody, you just want to be in service, you just want to see them smile.
Yeah.
These are pathways for love, you know, and these pathways of love can be open with anybody.
Right. Right. You dissolve into love. It's just a doorway. But once you get in there, that love is not tied to that person or that baby or that puppy.
Exactly. They're pathways.
Formless.
And and some pathways are wider and more intense than others. But these pathways, this pathway can be made with mint chocolate chip ice cream. This pathway.
Exactly.
It can be made with your favorite song. It can be made with anything. And our goal, because we've created this border, our ego is this border, this membrane that makes the drop think that it's separate from the ocean. And those moments that we dissolve the membrane, even temporarily, that's the moment that we become everything and nothing. Yeah. And that's the moment, that's that ultimate oneness that we feel. And whether you achieve that through meditation, whether you achieve that through amazing sex with somebody you care about, whether you achieve that through doing a plant medicine, you know, you know what I'm talking about. Mm. You know, whether you achieve that going cheek to cheek with a baby, however you have achieved it in the past, that comes through connectedness. Yeah. And we can create that connectedness with people. And we just have to be realistic with it. Not everybody you serve is going to express gratitude. And that's okay. Exactly. You're not servicing others to achieve to receive gratitude. You're servicing for the sake of servicing because you can service.
Yes.
And my mom taught me a story when I was really young and it's always stuck with me. Mm-hmm. It was about, you know, a man making roti for the community. And, you know, he was making them. And then a dog came and stole a bundle of them and ran away. And then he chased after the dog. And while he chased after the dog, he said, "Wait, wait, don't take those. I haven't buttered them yet." You know, his only concern was that the dog didn't get the right one. Yeah. Yeah. And it always made me think about this, which was just like, you know, it's so important to serve. And in my own journey, I've spent so much time trying to service myself, stroke my ego, validate myself, you know, all those cheap, you know, Canal Street knockoffs of love, validation, attention, you know, money, yeah. fame, all of that. And it wasn't realizing until I achieved a certain level of it that it doesn't
empty. empty.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. It does nothing to address that emptiness.
Yeah.
That we feel, you know, it does absolutely nothing. If anything, it can make things worse because now you're in a position where you have resources to further distract yourself.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. In 2013, that's what happened to me. Like I was at the height of like the curlynikki.com success. And I wasn't happy. And I knew that nothing, no more accolades, no other TV spots, you know, no other magazine interviews, like nothing was going to fill this void that I was very aware of. And I had been practicing that a form of spirituality. And I could tell that it wasn't the whole story. And I dove deep from 2013 until like 2 years ago. I'm just resurfacing. So it was necessary. Yeah. Necessary. Beautiful. And I found that love, you know, and it's like that love is all that's left. And there's no true practice. You know, it's really just, if I have to call it a practice, it's like just staying aware of and as this love and then being that, showing up as that, not as Nikki, but as love in every situation, in every moment, on every Zoom call, you know, at every meeting.
And if there is an act, it's sharing that love. Spreading it, you know, with an abundance mindset, realizing that your well will never go dry sharing love,
exactly.
even to those who are not in a position to feed it. Yep. Even to those who are not in a position to receive it, you know, because some
it's
people also have work to do to open up the wall, you know, open up the floodgates and tear down the walls that they've had to build dealing with previous trauma.
Exactly.
So they can't receive the love that you give. And that's okay. Your job isn't to ensure they received it. You know, you don't need that confirmation number of delivery. You just have to send it out.
Exactly.
You're sharing the overflow of love that you have in your life. So I appreciate you giving an opportunity to talk about all of that.
Yeah. I want to hear you tell my audience the Sisyphus story that I heard you share on your IG, one of your interviews. And it was powerful. And I feel like it's appropriate for the conversation we've been having.
Yes. So it's inspired by Albert Camus. So the last book I wrote is a book called Things No One Else Can Teach Us. And it was inspired by Albert Camus quote, which was, in the darkest of winters, I found within me an eternal summer.
Mm.
And Albert Camus. Oh,
that's good. That is powerful. I can feel that. I feel into that. That's good.
Yeah. He was a French philosopher. I think it was about, I want to say 100 years ago, probably.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think 100 years ago is still pretty modern. He died in a car accident, but I think it was 100 years ago or something like that.
Wow.
And his style of philosophy is known as absurdism, which is pretty much it's as whack as you think it is. But just laugh at it. That's the easiest way to put it.
I love that. Yep.
Yeah. Everything is just, you know, it's not some intoxicated optimism. It's like, hey, the world is exactly as whack as you think it is. And just laugh at the fact that it's whack. And, you know, popular TV shows that probably use Albert Camus, like Rick and Morty, BoJack Horseman. These are absurdist style comedies where they show you how whack life is, but they make it funny.
I love both of those. They're good.
Yeah. So he has his famous quote, and he says it in French, but the translation is, imagine Sisyphus happy. So Sisyphus is an old Greek story in the analogy of hell, which is man Sisyphus is pushing a really big boulder up a hill. And then once he gets to the top of the hill, the boulder just rolls down the other side.
Mm.
And they go back down, push the boulder right back up the hill and watch it roll down the other side. And this being a great analogy for life, because the moment you think you've achieved something, it just rolls all the way back down. You got to start all over. And the example I used in that last interview was like school. You know, you graduate high school, you know, you have a bunch of friends, you have a social status, you built a whole bunch of stuff, you know, by the end of high school, you know, when you're a senior, and then you roll back to the bottom of the hill. Now you're a freshman in college. You may have no social status. You may have no friends. You may not understand the new system of scheduling, school, accountability, all of that. Square one, spend 4 years there, figure it all out, get cool, get settled, get set. And then you graduate and now you're starting a new job. You're back down to the bottom. And it's this idea, you know, because we all catch ourselves promising ourselves when we get to the top of that hill, everything's going to be perfect and we'll live happily ever after. Because that's what happens on TV. There's a happily ever after because everything has to get condensed into that 22-minute television show. And Albert Camus just said, imagine Sisyphus happy. And there's a lot of value to this idea. There's another book called Maps of Meaning where Dr. Jordan Peterson is exploring the meaning of life. And he pretty much says the same thing, which is the meaning of life is to take on as much responsibility as you can. You know, and he said, you know, what if people actually want to push a boulder? And if we think about our own lives, there's so many times that we voluntarily do hard things and difficult things, and we don't actually want to chill and do nothing. We don't actually want to win the lottery and sit on a beach and drink all day.
Right. We want to be of service.
We want to be of service, or we want at least to have some purpose. We want to get up in the morning knowing what we have to do. Oftentimes right now for many of us, it's kind of chosen for us, whether we've set ourselves up in a life and we got to pay some debts and we got to, you know, pay some bills and we got to go to work. But then, you know, even if you pass that, like, there's got to be a purpose, whether it's a project, whether it's something else. And, you know, so for Albert Camus, say, imagine Sisyphus happy. He's like, imagine that boulder actually gives him meaning. And he knows the moment he gets to the top, it's going to roll back down. And he laughs at that and he does it again. And it's the same idea of, you know, you know the moment you graduate school, you're going to have to find something new to work on. You know the moment, you know, you find that person, now you got to plan the wedding. You know the moment you have that big, beautiful fairytale wedding, now you got to figure out your mortgage and pay off the debts from the wedding. You know, after you have your kids, you're going to set some new goals. And now they got to go to school and I got to watch their life cycle. And it's just kind of like, look, there isn't a way to just laugh at this. It is absurd, but it's funny. And, you know, life, the other favorite quote I have, and I can't attribute it at the present moment, but life is a comedy to those who think and a tragedy to those who feel. And I think if we just keep, you know, jumping back and forth between the thinking and feeling, we'll gain a healthier vision of what this life is and what it can be. Yeah. And those moments where we don't feel so good, it's also an opportunity for us to connect with others who have always not been feeling so good, instead of falling into the trap of feeling like a victim.
Right. Oh, that's so good. Well, please tell my audience at home how they can connect with you.
You can find me on Instagram at Humble the Poet. And I've also started my own online community called Humble the Poet's Handsome Friends. And that's just at humblethepoet.com/community. And the spirit of that community is to create something that is built like social media, but it's not as exhausting and it's not as heavy.
I saw that. That was when I read it, I'm like, first of all, you're a genius. Second of all, thank you. Because you can only do so much curating of your feed. It's heavy, period. It's a heavy ass experience every time you get on social media. So to be able to know you're going somewhere with like-minded people.
And also this idea of, like, you know, I'm grateful I have a big audience now for my work, but the next level of that is it's not about how many people know who Humble the Poet is. It's how many people have, you know, how do we connect these nodes of other people as well? Yeah. You know, it's like going to your favorite concert and making a friend there. Sometimes it's not even about who's on stage. It's about
the fellowship and it's the engagement, not you engaging with every individual, but them engaging with each other.
Because I wanted to. I don't have to care. You know, I'm fortunate again with the big numbers, but I couldn't reply to every message I get. I'm sure you feel the same way.
Absolutely.
So when I created this community, you know, it's just beautiful and brilliant because they get to communicate with each other. So if somebody posts, you know, so now when people reach out to me with challenges and problems, I encourage them to go there because not only can I chime in, but there's also 15, 20 other people that can also chime in with their ideas, their experiences, their perspectives. And that's the thing too. I am aware of, you know, my privileges, you know, I am a visible minority and I am part of a marginalized community, but I'm also a male. And there's certain privileges that come with being a male. I'm also a heterosexual male. There's certain privileges that come with being a heterosexual male. I'm also living in the first world. I'm also self-employed. You know, these are all things that are privileges that I recognize. So hearing people who are from different communities have different perspectives on things. And sometimes I'm still, you know, the old me still wants to tell people to suck it up sometimes. And sometimes before I get a chance to tell anyone to suck it up, there's already five people messaging and flooding that individual with empathy, kindness, and caring. And me realizing that, hey, sometimes people aren't telling, and this is, and, you know, this is the common issue, I think, with guys. You know, you hear a problem, you think you need to solve it. And sometimes you just need to hear it. And the only thing you need to say is, all you need to do is show that you hear them. Like, hey, I hear you. That must suck. I'm sorry that's happening. And, you know, that's something I'm learning, because that wasn't, you know, I wasn't raised in an environment where that was encouraged. You know, and that's nobody's fault. You know, the people were raised in an environment like that too. And it's up to me to recognize that and break the pattern. So this community has taught me so much, and people have already been messaging me within this community, talking about the friendships they've made. You know, it's geo, it has a geography tab to it. So you can find people in your area, in your neighborhood. You can find people in your city, in your country. So sometimes I have, you know, followers in Indonesia or some other places that, you know, I might never get a chance to ever be out there, but now they can find other people, and that I'm the starting point of their relationship.
Exactly.
And
now they can,
you know, and the truth of the matter is, it's not two people who are fans of Humble the Poet. It's two people who are on a journey that, you know, someone like Humble the Poet can add value to, which means they have so much more in common. So and I'm loving it. You know, we're approaching 10,000 members. It's much smaller than my social media, but it's still at a level where I can reply to all the DMs. It's still at a level where I can read everybody's comments, like everybody's stuff. But the followers isn't a thing, or it might be a thing, not front and center. Likes isn't a thing.
Yes.
You know, there's very little curation.
Authenticity is a thing. Transparency is a thing. That's awesome.
And the one, you know, I do have the power to highlight content that I like. And one of the ones I highlighted was just somebody asking, what's your favorite thing about this community? And just, I wanted people to read the answers, and the answers are just like, everybody is so kind here. It is so light. I don't feel that I have to be anybody here. And I think, you know, social media had the right idea when they first started, but, you know, as their priorities changed and they turned into vehicles to advertise and sell us a bunch of shit that we don't need and keep us on their platforms as long as possible, they really started to turn into kind of fast food. And, you know, they stopped focusing on what we need or what we would like to have, and they just focused on what we would be addicted to. You know, and that's just a lot of deliciousness or a lot of emotionally charging stuff. You know,
the outrage posts.
The outrage. Yes, all of that.
What are we mad at today?
Exactly. What do we have to worry about today? It allows us to feel like every problem is our problem. And we're not designed for this. We you know, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, we lived in small communities where everybody knew everybody. And we took care of our communities and we were accountable to our communities. And I'm not saying those communities were perfect, because everybody had a role to play. And sometimes those roles were not equitable, especially to women. But that's how we were still designed to be in these smaller communities. And now we're part of these communities of hundreds of thousands and millions of people. And now we're supposed to take everything everybody says as seriously as possible. Like, it's impossible. It's just it's like just eating McDonald's French fries nonstop. You know, it's it's delicious, but it's definitely not nutritious. And
absolutely not.
That's what and that's what I'm trying to recognize. And I was actually going to quit social media until this idea was presented to me, which was, you know, don't just give up on the people that are connected with you, you know, find a solution. So this community, humblethepoet.com/community is my effort at not complaining and creating a solution and an alternative. And I'm encouraging people to come check it out, join the family. We're lighthearted, we're fun. And again, we don't do too much curation unless one or two, you know, people who cross certain lines get involved, but we don't really have to at this point. And I'm loving it. I like being on there, and I love the fact that I'm not the center of attention.
Well, thank you for that service, and I hope y'all will check it out. I know that I will. Thank you again for joining me, taking the time out of your day to share all these beautiful gems today.
No problem. Did we answer all the questions that your friend wanted to answer as well?
Oh, you know what? Let me pull those up. I don't want to get one of them. I remember because it was also okay. My question. He wants to know veg or no veg, and if it matters for enlightenment. That's one of his two questions.
Okay, I mean that's an interesting one for me. So I grew up vegetarian. So my mom discovered spirituality or she began her spiritual journey when I was about 7. Mm-hmm. And that influenced the household. And then our household turned vegetarian. Mm-hmm. Cause that was a
when you were 7, you went vegetarian. 7. Okay.
But I wasn't a big meat eater before that. I don't think I'd ever had a Big Mac, or I wasn't eating a lot of just meat in general.
Like bacon every morning for breakfast.
No, that wasn't the case. A lot of our traditional, the thing too is in India, if you go to a restaurant in India, the categories are veg and non-veg. So vegetarian is the default, right? A lot of cultures are inherited to their vegetarian. So I grew up vegetarian, and it really wasn't discussed as a topic. It was just you're vegetarian. And I already wasn't the most excited around different meats. I'm meaning during the summer of 2020, I was working on a project where I was trying to, I was doing some modeling, and I had to fit in certain clothes, and I had certain fitness goals, and I was talking to the trainer, and he gave me my vegetarian meal plan. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, I live on my own and I'm not the greatest cook. And I was like, this is complicated. And
I
was like,
I don't cook. I'm vegetarian and I don't cook. It's hard. So be vegetarian and not cook. Hard. It's
especially when a lot of the alternatives aren't as healthy as they may seem.
Right.
Yeah. So then my trainer was like, or you're going to eat meat. He goes, and the thing with meat is, if you go with the organics and you go with this, whatever, there's that. So I started, I literally started eating meat last summer. In terms of spiritual and spirituality practices, again, I'm sure it could have an impact. As I said, I put service above everything else. I mean, obviously eating meat has an impact also on your carbon footprint. You know, the biggest polluter in the world is the beef industry. So contributing to that could also be an issue. In terms of, I think about the dietals I've had to do when I've done different plant medicines, whether it was ayahuasca, having a mushroom ceremony, 5-MeO-DMT. I've always had, you're given different dietals what to eat or not eat beforehand. Yeah. When I was a complete vegetarian, I was given dietals, you know, that was easy to follow because I wasn't eating meat. I just had to stay away from caffeine or dairy and stuff like that. I didn't necessarily notice a benefit. Okay. And as a meat eater, I've only done two different ones. Mm-hmm. And I went vegetarian for that. I didn't notice that much of a difference. Okay. But I do believe probably from a no-brainer perspective, especially with just the commodification and corporatization of food and farming, you're probably better off not eating meat if you can. However, as a consumer, as somebody who grew up in a capitalist society, it is dramatically easier to accomplish your feeding goals if you eat meat. So I look at it from that perspective. But I think in the long term, if I wanted to continue with it, I would like to look into sourcing it myself versus getting it from the grocery store and not knowing what's happening there. And viewing it from a perspective that, you know, the First Nation people here had, which was, you know, a place of gratitude and a place of complete usage and all of that. And understanding the idea that we don't have a life, that we are life.
Yeah.
You know, and as I said, we're all sourced, and you know, and there is no life and death when it comes to that concept of it. But I understand the ethics, I understand all of that. And as I said, I'm not in any way, shape, or form perfect or preaching a message of perfection in any way. So was a vegetarian for a very long time. Currently am not a vegetarian. Still find myself not the biggest fan. I mean, I eat chicken breasts and I eat a steak once in a while, but I'm not going out. I haven't had McDonald's. Yeah. I haven't gone to a fast food restaurant or a nice restaurant and had a bunch of meat. It was just more so like, this is easy to cook at home. And this has helped me achieve the fitness goals that I need to accomplish for this modeling gig. And that was
modeling gig. That's dope. I'm a flexitarian.
I modeled underwear.
Okay, then. Nice. Very nice. Yeah, I'm a flexitarian. I go back and forth between like veganism, vegetarianism, and then eating fish. In 2019, I was in Spain. I ate a lot of meat and then I went vegan to kind of detox, but I'm vegetarian presently.
Yeah.
His other question is, why do we need guru to reach the Almighty? He says, I just want to know what he thinks about that.
So let's start with what guru means. Guru means dark. Ru means light. So, you know, guru is somebody who can help take you from darkness to light. Mm-hmm. You can look at that from like spiritual darkness to light or ignorance to light, or, you know, mm-hmm. So anybody who's teaching you something, who's illuminating you, is your guru from that. You know, my trainer is my boxing guru.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people on YouTube whose recipes I watch and learn how to cook, they're my guru. Yeah. So I think a spiritual guru would be the same, along the same lines. So I come from Sikh heritage. So the guru in Sikh heritage right now is Guru Granth Sahib. Guru, Granth mean compilation. So it's a collection of writing from six of the 10 Sikh gurus. So six mm-hmm. of them, the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and the ninth, their writings are included in there as
I've
well.
I've been reading it for the last year.
Oh, lovely. And if you check that out, it's literally just the most inspiring love poems to the
it
Almighty.
It is, you know? Truly, truly.
You're not going to find a lot of do this, don't do this. You're not going to find a lot of that. You're going to find a lot of expressions of love, a lot of poetry, and a lot of philosophical ideas. But also it includes writing from people like Kabirji, Bhagat Ravi Das, people from other faiths, other ideas, and just everybody kind of maintaining this kind of same concept of service, meditation, your Kamkrodh Lobh Mohankar, which is your ego, your attachment, your anger, your lust, and your greed being five roadblocks to your peace.
Absolutely.
So these being the main ideas. So I believe that we're all students and we should be lifelong learners. Mm-hmm. I am not personally the biggest fan of, I understand why it happens, worship, mm-hmm. in terms of especially worshiping a guru or a person. I think its origins kind of come from our survival. So it's like, you know, if we were in small tribes and one individual was an amazing hunter, we would look up to them for being an amazing hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how, that was a survival tactic to learn how to hunt better,
yep.
like them. But not only would we copy their hunting styles, we may start dressing like them. We may start walking like them. We may start acting like them. We may do our, you know, and that's no different than, you know, we admire LeBron James. So now we wear his shoes. Now we drink Sprite. Now we drive the car he drives. If he wears a certain shirt, we do that. There's something inherent in us that makes us kind of worship and look up to people that way.
Yeah.
Especially people that accomplish things that feel beyond human, you know, an amazing actor, you know, the celebrity culture that we have, you know, it's in line with what we've always been doing. And I see that when it comes to spirituality, which is like, this person is my guru. I'm going to bow down to their feet. I'm going to pay their bills. I'm going to do all of this type of stuff. I'm not the biggest fan of that. I don't think it's essentially necessary. I see the value of humility. I see the value great student. But at the same time, I think there's a danger in that, especially if you have someone who takes themselves really seriously. And I mean, there's plenty of stories of, you know, those powers that these individuals have being abused.
Absolutely.
I mean, I have mentors, I have people who are my teachers, but then those relationships go back and forth. So, you know, I work with another rapper who's a brilliant freestyler. So he's my freestyle guru, and then I'm his pen to paper guru. I give him homework in terms of how to put pen to paper. He gives me homework in terms of just coming off the top. You know, I have friends who are, you know, teaching me to be a better writer, or I have friends who are teaching me, you know, mentors in business, or I have, you know, mentors in relationships and mentors in the hustle or fitness, you know, and at the same time, I could also be, you know, my trainer teaches me how to work out properly and I teach him how to strengthen his social media. Yeah. I like that each one teach one. I'm not the biggest prescriber in terms of certain individuals were given all the secrets and now everything's only unlocked through them.
Yep.
I believe we collectively, and even the most impactful document in human history, which is the Bible, whether you believe in it or not, we don't debate its impact on the planet. It was a collaborative effort. written over many, many, many years, written by many, many, many people. And I also am a strong believer that we can have the answers without knowing why, because there's a lot coded into us. There's a lot of essence that exists into us. So I, you know, I was raised in a heritage that didn't worship other people, and Sikh heritage doesn't have a hierarchy. We don't have a priesthood. We don't have any of this type of stuff. And what we refer to as the Almighty, whether you call it God, the Source, the Great Algorithm, God, whatever, you know, Waheguru, you know, Allah, it exists within, you know, the quickest source is within.
Can we say that that's the guru? Because that's what I was going to say for me as a response to his question. To me, like that love that I found here that I can say is within, but there's no within or without, but just this love is the guru.
Yeah. And as I said, I think the student mind, because Sikh, to be S-I-K-H, that means student.
Mm.
So I think it's more about continually, and it's just really interesting, just, you know, relating this to something that may not seem related. They did a study on, you know, some of the most impactful, successful humans in the world, whether you like them or not. Let's for example, an Elon Musk, you know, his impact and his success aren't denied.
Yeah.
What they've been able to do is they've been able to create mental models in their brain where they actually get dopamine drops from failure. So when they try something and it doesn't work, they get the same chemical reaction in their brain as if it did work. So they see the value in failure. They see the enthusiasm towards failure, which is something that we had as students. You know, you're in grade six doing a science experiment and you're trying to figure out how to get this egg from one location to another without cracking it.
Yes.
If it cracks, you don't beat yourself up. You're like, oh my God, I'm a horrible failure. You laugh it off. You guys try it again.
Do it again.
And over time, we lose that. We lose that curiosity. We lose that enthusiasm towards being like, okay, I found a way. So it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why a lot of successful people aren't afraid to fail, because they maintain that, or they continually train themselves to do so to a point where it becomes, you know, chemically beneficial to them. So I think more so, you know, what I would say is, another beautiful quote that I love is, no one is my friend. No one is my enemy. Everyone is my teacher.
That's good and true.
So I will say a guru is essential to meet the Almighty, but your guru is everybody. If it's just so-and-so, you know, they could be your primary one. They could teach you a lot of stuff. But, you know, I know for me, especially after the success of my books, people wanted to put me on that box and on that pedestal as a self-help guru. And I've made it clear. I'm like, no, I'm a regular, completely flawed guy who can put words together well, because I taught young children and I can rap. I put a lot of ideas, and I'm curious. So I'll read the heavy stuff and then make it light
and repackage it for
synthesize it. I'll do that work.
Yeah.
But none of that means I'm the source of this. None of that means I have some, you know, divine connection that nobody else is able to tap into and stuff. And I should never be taken serious. And at the same time, you know, I also enjoy partying, and I also have many ex-girlfriends who won't have nice things to say about me. And, you know, I'm a normal guy, and everybody can be a normal human being and be on this journey. And I think that's important, because I do see, you know, but at the same time, I benefit greatly from mentorship of people. And as once this brilliant, magical Uber driver I had once, he explained to me, his mentors are the OGs and the young kids in his neighborhood.
I love that.
He goes, he has as much to learn from an OG as he has to learn from the 5-year-old kids watching them chase leaves in the wind. And that to me is, make everybody your guru, then definitely a guru is essential.
Ah, that's so powerful. I'm taking that with me. That's a beautiful practice to recognize that in every person you meet too, you know, in every individual, meeting them with that idea in the back of your mind. Well, thank you again. I truly appreciate you. Thank you all at home for joining us again. I'll be back soon. I love you so much. Send me an email if you need anything. Talk to you later.
Much love. Mm-hmm.